From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we investigate the mystery of why some television is so good and some so bad. Carl Sauter was the story editor of Moonlighting during its first 2 years. His new book, How to Sell Your Screenplay, is an insider's account of the industry from the writer's perspective. Also today, Steve Reich discusses his new composition, Different Trains. He thinks of it as a breakthrough piece that's led him into a new form, which he describes as documentary music. Pianist Dave McKenna plays a spring medley in our weekly performance spot. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews Alexander Stewart's new novel about incest, The War Zone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Carl Sauter remembers the night he lost control, a night several years before he became a successful TV scriptwriter. He was watching a particularly mindless episode of Three's Company when he screamed at his television, "I can write that junk." And as he sat down at the typewriter, he asked himself, "But is it really so easy to write that badly?" Carl Sauter was one of the lucky ones. He not only broke into TV, he became the story editor of one of TV's best-written, most innovative programs, Moonlighting. In 1986, he won a Writers Guild Award for the episode The Dream Sequence Always Rings Twice. That's the one where David and Maddie dream that they're a trumpeter and singer back in the 1940s. In 1988, Sauter won another Writers Guild Award for the episode It's a Wonderful Job. Now he's writing screenplays. Lots of viewers yell at their TVs the same words Sauter once yelled at his. For these hopeful writers, Sauter has written the book How to Sell Your Screenplay, The Real Rules of Film and Television. He also lectures on the same subject at the American Film Institute. Carl Sauter, welcome to Fresh Air.
So the first thing, thank you for having me
on. The first thing I have to ask you, is it easy to write that badly? What do you think?
No, it's not at all. The number one message I try to give to writers and to viewers is don't be fooled by how bad so much of our film and television is. That's not how people get into the industry. You have to write better than what you see on the screen.
So how come what we see on the screen isn't as good as people are capable of writing?
Because it's such a collaborative process. Every movie you've seen or every television episode goes through a lot of steps before the final product is made. Often there was a good idea or there was even a pretty good script somewhere along the way. But because this is such a collaborative form, it's very hard to keep the sort of essence of a script intact. And what often happens is that they tend to fall apart in every rewrite.
Before we get to talking about your experiences on Moonlighting, I'd like for you to unravel some of the mysteries of television for us and explain some of the things that we see. Most TV shows have certain formulas, and they seem to follow just a certain formula from week to week. The opening's very similar, the closing's very similar. You can predict what the character is going to do. This is intentional, isn't it?
It is. We try not to use the word formula because it implies that, you know, it's, you just cut it out of a cookie cutter every week. But it is an F word. The word is franchise. The principle behind most of our television is that viewer loyalty is very important, and that on every show there are certain givens every week that an audience tunes in to see. For example, if you watch Murder, She Wrote, you expect a crime. You expect, you know, five suspects for it, and you expect that Angela Lansbury will figure out some clever way to solve the mystery. That becomes the franchise of the show. The challenge for a writer is within those limits to be real original and real clever, and that's where our television tends to fall apart.
Do most television shows have Bibles where they spell out what the characteristics are of all the characters on the show?
They're supposed to. It's very helpful if you're a freelance writer coming in to pitch ideas. It's very important to know what you can and can't do with a character, and it's not always apparent just from watching the show. A lot of it's very subtle. I mentioned Murder, She Wrote. On that show, one of the biggest problems they have, for example, is getting Angela Lansbury into the story because they don't want her to be a meddler. So she can't come charging in and say, "I'm going to solve this mystery." She has to be pulled into it. That's why she has all those damn relatives.
That's right. Oh, she sure
they
does.
Need a way. They need a way to get her into the story. That's the kind of background that writers need to have before they try and write for a show.
Why are dramas 1 hour and sitcoms 1 half hour?
It's a great question. Nobody, I think, can really answer it well. There has historically been this belief that you can't be funny for more than half an hour on television. Of course, feature films belie that because, you know, feature films have to be funny for 2 hours. That really has only started to change in the last few years, and Moonlighting was really one of the first shows that sort of crossed the line between comedy and drama in 1 hour. At the time that Moonlighting came on, there was another show called Crazy Like a Fox. And the first time that both shows were eligible for the Emmys, there was enormous brouhaha about what category they were going to be in, because up until then, there had never really been an hour show that had that much comedy in it.
Are there any rules of thumb about the number of laughs per show you're supposed to have if the show is funny?
Yes, in half-hour sitcoms, they call it the rule of three, which it's an informal rule, but not all that informal, that there should be three laughs per page. Now, a page in a situation comedy is about 45 seconds. That's very hard to do, to be funny three times and tell a story.
Well, isn't the rule of three also that you're supposed to build on that one joke two other times?
Yes, and it's interesting. An awful lot of screenwriting comes in threes. Lists are funnier in threes. And yes, in the build on a joke, one of the old comedy principles is that something is funny once, it's even funnier the third time. But it has to keep building. You can't do the same joke over and over. You have to go, you know, good, better, best. And that's the comedy rule of three.
Here's one of the mysteries to me. Why are there still laugh tracks? Everybody's hip to them. Everybody knows that these people laughed years ago and are probably dead now, although their laughter has been recorded. Everybody understands how it's supposed to operate on them. I don't know of anybody who likes laugh tracks. I know they've been eliminated on some shows, yet they're still on lots of others.
They are, and it's real frustrating because it is an artificial device to sort of point out where the jokes are, and I think it really hurts the writing. I've not worked on a show that has a laugh track, so I've actually never had the experience of having people laugh too loudly at something that I wrote. But I think part of it is because a lot of times our television scripts are so bad, people aren't sure which parts were supposed to be funny. And one of the things that a laugh track does is kind of point out, oh, that was funny. I think it's not a good device, and I applaud the move away from it on an awful lot of shows.
I always wonder on the particularly bad episodic TV shows, whether the producers like the show or whether they're very, very cynical people who think, well, I don't like this, but I know those dumb listeners out there will.
Unfortunately, there's an enormous amount of cynicism, and it's a very prestige-oriented industry. So when you work on one of the critically acclaimed shows, you feel better about yourself, you feel better about your writing, you get more reinforcement. I don't think anybody sets out to make a bad television episode or sets out to make a bad movie, and there are just as many bad movies out on a daily basis as there are television shows. What happens is that for whatever reasons, in the process of putting it together, something that could have been good deteriorates. That's the great mystery of this industry. It's very hard to understand how some projects end up being so good and others end up just consistently being so bad.
My guest is Carl Sauter, and he was the story editor for Moonlighting during its first 2 years, and he won two Writers Guild Awards for his scripts. He's also the author of the book How to Sell Your Screenplay. Let's talk about your experiences on Moonlighting. Now, you had explained to us what a franchise is, that it's basically the plot rules and the characterization rules for a series. Did Moonlighting have one? You started at the beginning, right?
Yes, I started. I was not there for the first few episodes, but I was a story editor for basically the first season and a half once they knew that Moonlighting was going to go on for a couple of years. And it had some very definite rules. The major one was, and it was great training as a writer, the major one was be very inventive within the limits established by the show. So, for example, we only, in the first season, only had three characters to work with, Maddie, David, and then Miss DePesto. Anytime our stories started to rely too much on outside characters, Glenn Caron, who created the show, would pull us back from that, saying those guest characters are not what the show is about. We had an informal rule that if you got to a story where you were introducing more than three guest characters in a week, we weren't going to be able to spend enough time with Maddie and David. And so we went through and started cutting out the extra characters to get down to the story.
Moonlighting was one of the first shows in what I think is still a trend, and that is that the two main characters have a sexual attraction for each other, but they never consummate it. Now, Maddie and David have since consummated, but...
Yes.
But there was at least a couple of years in which, you know, that was so much of the plot twist every week, was that you could tell they were really interested in each other, but they resisted. Was this a conscious thing in the story?
Oh, very conscious decision.
What was the rationale behind it?
Well, when Glenn first sold the idea for Moonlighting, he sold it as Cheers with Murder. And so it was very much the same sort of ongoing tension between the two main characters as in Cheers. Remington Steele had a very similar sort of setup for mm-hmm. the show. The problem is it's very hard to sustain that. For those people out there who are Cheers fans, and I think it's consistently one of the best written shows on television, they had the same problems Moonlighting did in the second season. They could not decide whether to consummate or not to consummate. Because once you've done that, it's very hard. You can't go back. You've got to find other things to do with the characters. And yet you feel real guilty week to week, sort of teasing the audience. And you fear that people are going to get bored with that. So while it was a very intriguing way to start the show, it's also the thing that a long-term probably most hurt the show, because it was unclear where to go with it.
So you'd have philosophical discussions from week to week?
Oh, yes.
Whether they should get together or not.
Yes. Yes, in terms of because you feel a great responsibility to an audience. There's enormous loyalty, and when you're on a hit show like Moonlighting, you really hear from people a lot. I mean, you get everything we did. I mean, good or bad. I mean, it felt like we knew about it very quickly from the people who watched the show. I had left, but in the infamous episode where Maddie got married, I mean, they literally knew within 24 hours of that episode that in terms of its public support, it had been a disastrous decision to make. And the next day after it aired, they started the process of untangling it.
That's right. Another innovation of Moonlighting was that Maddie and David, and this is, of course, the Sybil Shepherd and Bruce Willis character, they address the audience and acknowledge that they're characters in a television program. Whose idea was it to do that?
That was Glenn Caron's idea, and it came about not out of any brilliant creative decision. It came about because it was a gigantic hole in the plot of the first episode where it was done, and we didn't know what to do. We were always way behind. We did not have time to rewrite the script or refilm things. And Glenn said, we're just going to have David turn to the audience and say something, and people will be so stunned they'll never notice that there was this gigantic hole in the plot. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. And that then became part of the franchise for the show, that once or twice every episode, usually David would turn to the camera and sort of acknowledge that he was in a television show.
Was it a plot hole that you were responsible for?
Well, it was kind of a group plot hole. As I remember, it was an episode in which we were never really decided if a particular character got killed or not.
This could be a problem.
It could be a problem. But interesting, you know, we got all this incredible fan mail and all these phone calls about how brilliant it was that David turned to the camera. We never got a letter about that huge hole in the plot. So it was a very interesting lesson in sort of diverting an audience's attention.
Well, I think it's very rare that a producer of a television show will suggest that you do something as unusual and innovative as that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the great treats of working on Moonlighting, was that originality got rewarded. We used to sit in our story meetings, and Glenn would say, you know, I don't want sixes. I don't want, you know, mediocre ideas. I want tens. You know, give me things that are really inventive and really different. The one way that you will not fail on the show is by taking risks. And that was a wonderful attitude to sort of, you know, cut my teeth on in television.
How close to deadline were your scripts written?
After. I mean, we were literally writing scripts at some points that where they were shooting. I wrote on Moonlighting with a terrific partner, a woman named Deborah Frank. And in one famous episode, we were sitting at the typewriter writing the scene. And Glenn came rushing into the room and said, we've run out of material on the set. Give me that. And halfway through the scene, he just pulled it out of the typewriter and himself ran it down to deliver to the set. You really can't cut it any closer than that.
Is this one of the reasons why Moonlighting ended up having so many reruns?
Exactly. Because we tended to be so far behind on the scripts, we just could not get them done in time to do new episodes. Just to shoot an episode takes 7 working days. So, you know, you cannot, in our television, not to mention the editing and the casting and all the mechanics that go into every hour of television. So what happened was, as soon as we fell behind on the scripts, we could just never catch up. And every year the show worked real hard to try and, you know, do it right from the beginning. But there's a real tendency in television, because it's such a pressure cooker, to fall behind. And Moonlighting was as bad at that as anyone.
You know, by the way, Moonlighting's moving to Sunday nights now, and they're advertising 7 episodes in a row without reruns.
I know. I was on the Academy Awards, and I was just laughing hysterically, because it's pretty sad when you're at a point where you
have to promo
a show by saying, no reruns, 7 new episodes. It'd be very interesting to see what happens. I have a lot of affection and obviously owe a tremendous debt to the show. It may, though, be a victim of a larger problem in our television, which is whenever we buy a series, we buy it for 5 years. It's very hard to sustain the quality of a show over that length of time. That's why most of what you see tends to fall apart in the second or third year. Moonlighting is a good example of a show that probably would have benefited from how the Europeans do television, which is they buy a particular number of episodes and that's it. And Moonlighting probably would have been a terrific show for a year or 2 years. But you know, our system, unfortunately, is always looking for the long-running show.
I want to talk with you more about your experiences writing for television. We'll also get to some of your experiences writing now for film. But first, we'll take a short break. My guest is Carl Sauter. He's the author of the new book, How to Sell Your Screenplay, and the former story editor for Moonlighting. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Carl Sauter is my guest. He was the story editor for Moonlighting during its first 2 years, and 2 of his episodes won Writers Guild Awards for Best TV Drama. Sauter also lectures on how to write screenplays and sell them, and he's written a book called How to Sell Your Screenplay. Let's talk about one of the episodes that won a Writers Guild Award, and I'm thinking of the black and white episode, The Dream Sequence Always Rings Twice, and part of this is set in a 1940s nightclub where Maddie's a singer and David is a trumpeter. Was this your idea to do this kind of a dream flashback?
It was actually
type of thing.
I mentioned my partner on Moonlighting, Deborah Franken. It was actually her idea, and it was an idea that she had pitched to other shows, and people looked at her like she was mad. And our very first meeting with Moonlighting, I just thought it was a great idea. And we went in and pitched it to Glenn, and he went nuts over it. And that actually is the episode that got us our very first job with Moonlighting.
How did you pitch the episode?
We pitched it very simply. A lot of what I try and do in the book is talk about the real way that it works. When you watch bad film or television, people get fooled. They think that complicated plots and lots of elaborate effects are really what screenwriting is about, and that's not true. Good screenwriting is good storytelling, and in the case of that episode, the story that we told was very simple. We wanted Maddie and David to get preoccupied with a murder that happened in the 40s, and then in separate dreams become the characters as a way to act out the tension in their relationship set in the 40s. It was really pitched that simply and that directly. We talked about the possibility of doing it in black and white, which Glenn was a huge fan of that notion. He also very much liked the idea that both Bruce and Sybil would get a chance to be involved in music. So it was an idea that just sold immediately as soon as we started talking about it.
Now, you were story editor for 2 years on Moonlighting. What does that mean exactly?
Well, story editor is a staff writer. It's one of the things you try and do if you write television, because it's very hard to sustain a career as a freelancer. Freelancers move around from one show to another. And being staff on a show means that you have a steady income and you're very much involved in the whole process of a show. Basically, what a story editor does is meet with writers, look at writing samples, sit in on sessions where writers come in and pitch their ideas, and also rewrite scripts. we would often work with scripts that other writers had done, and we would redo the scenes or redo the dialogue to try and improve it.
You have heard, I'm sure, lots of people pitch story ideas, and I think that's probably taught you about the mistakes people make and the wrong ideas that they have about how television gets made. When you were doing Moonlighting, what were some of the most commonly pitched ideas?
We had a list. I was astounded because I had never sat on that side of the process before, where you met with writers all day long and heard their ideas. And the first message that comes across is people are incredibly unoriginal. You are thrilled when a writer comes in and tells you a story you haven't heard before. For people who are interested in this as a possible career, the first advice that I give is to don't sit down and come up with movie ideas, and don't sit down and come up with TV ideas. If we've seen it 100 times in film and television, it is no longer a good idea. It's not an original idea. The stories that were most often pitched at Moonlighting were Maddie and David are trapped, you know, in an elevator shaft, on a boat, in the Xerox room, you know, in a mountain cabin. And every writer would talk about this idea like it was the most amazing original story we'd ever heard. So much so that we finally started to say to writers before they came in, please don't pitch Maddie and David are trapped. The problem with that as a story idea is that it can't go anywhere. Maddie and David are trapped, they fight, they make up, they fight, they get out. There's no surprises in the story, which means that it's a story that's not well structured for film or television.
Have you had to deal with standards and practices a lot? Did you have things that were changed at the suggestion of the networks?
Yeah, very much so, particularly on Moonlighting, because one of the great joys for Moonlighting was to see how far we could stretch the rules. And one of the advantages of doing scripts at the last minute is often the network didn't have time to get the jokes before they were on the air, whereas if we had given them the scripts a month ahead of time, they may have kind of finally figured out, gee, that's a pretty dirty joke, and we're not going to let that on. That whole process in the industry has really changed dramatically, and just in the last few years, it used to be when you did a script, you got back notes on all your lines, and they would trade two dams for a hell and all of that. That whole process has gotten much more liberal, and there are really only a very few things you can't do on television now.
What are they?
So a couple of those four-letter words haven't quite crossed over, though. I mean, I was astounded. Just this year, if you look at some of the words like bitch that are now common in most screenplays, even 2 or 3 years ago, you could not put that into a script. So I think the audience can guess the couple that haven't made it onto the list yet.
You reprint some of the notes that Standards and Practices sent down to the writers of Soap. And Soap was a sitcom a few years ago with Billy Crystal in it. And it was one of the first sitcoms to have a recurring gay character on it. And these are pretty interesting. I'm just going to read a couple of the notes that were sent back. Delete the word slut. Delete the word fruitcake. Please ensure that Benson's self-effacing portrayal is always played tongue-in-cheek and that he continues to stay one-up vis-a-vis his antagonists. In order to be able to treat the mafia storyline here and throughout, it will be necessary to introduce a principal, continuing character of Italian descent who is very positive and who will, through the dialogue and action, balance and counter any negative stereotypes. And then in order to treat Jody as a gay character, his portrayal must at all times be handled without limp-wristed actions or other negative stereotyping. You know, a few of the notes in here are about objectionable language, but most of the notes in here are about stereotypes and how they fear they might be offending a segment of the community that would be viewing.
Very much so. You make a great point, because there is another side to Standards and Practices, which is to try and not promote stereotypes and cliches. A lot of what Soap did, of course, was make fun of the whole form of the soap opera. And so the soap opera has had a tendency to have cliched characters, and as a result, Soap sometimes lapsed into making what in the network's eyes constituted making too much fun of those characters. So that's a fairly responsible side of the industry. The problem you have as a writer is sometimes the anti-clichés become the clichés, if
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, the super black character, the black mom who does everything, you know, those. In this day and age, you have to be very careful as a writer to offer real characters as opposed to clichés one way or the other.
You were so anxious to break into television. It seems to me shortly after you got in, you got out.
I know. I'm a shallow kind of guy. What can I say? Television was very hard. The being on staff for me was just an incredible grind. I had a whole nother career that I talk about in the book, and that I was in, of all things, government for 15 years. And I had been on Moonlighting for a week, my first staff job, and I walked into the executive producer's office and I said, this is why I left government. All I do is have meetings, deal with politics. You know, I left working in government so I would never have to talk to the city council again. And here I am, in effect, talking to a city council, pitching story ideas. It's the same process. I was astounded. The reason that I became a writer was to write and to have more time by myself. And what I found being on staff on a show was it was exactly the same process I had been through in the city of Pasadena. I also, Deborah and I, were very lucky because it's very hard to move from television into feature films, and we started getting feature film offers early on in the process at Moonlighting, and it was a step that I really wanted to make, and so we finally decided to leave the show to do that.
Now, one of your screenwriting credits, although it wasn't credited on the screen, is you did one of the rewrites for My Stepmother as an Alien.
I was one of 12 writers on that poor film, and Deborah and I did. We were right in the middle of it. What people often don't realize is that there are lots and lots of writers whose names you'll never see, who somewhere along the way in the process of a movie either did a draft or were involved. That film was a classic example of something I was saying at the beginning, of a movie that sort of fell apart along the way. The version of the script that we were handed was a pretty terrific script with a lot of substance to it. It had very little to do with the movie that they ultimately made. So for writers who think, oh, I could write My Stepmother as an Alien, the part of the process they don't see is that they would have to write a better script than that to get into the industry.
It seems like it would be a whole lot more direct to just write bad scripts and sell them.
Well,
rather than
writing
good ones
be.
And then water them down.
And unfortunately, that's one of the hardest messages to get out to writers. It was one of the hardest things for me to learn. It took me 6 years of working very hard to get into this industry. One of the biggest mistakes I was making along the way was writing at the level of what I saw, not understanding that you have to write better than that to get into the industry. Most of the episodes that are on most television series, if they had been submitted as writing samples, those writers probably would never have gotten in the door. The sort of rule of thumb is that a lot of good scripts in this industry don't get made, but good writers always get noticed because there just are not that many of them.
Do you think that television is on the whole getting any better or getting any worse?
I have to say it's getting better. I think if you look at the schedule now versus the schedule of 10 years ago, there is more variety, there are more interesting kinds of shows. It's a hard medium to improve quickly. It tends to, the progress in television tends to be measured by little bits here and there. There was no such thing as a Wonder Years even 4 years ago. There was no such thing as an L.A. Law 10 years ago, pre-Hill Street Blues. So that I think that there's a lot of good news happening on television. I feel the same way about feature films. I look at the last year's crop of films, and for the first time, I think films began to skew more to an adult audience. So I'm generally pretty upbeat about that. You're going to increasingly see improvements in the quality.
Well, Carl, I want to thank you a lot for telling us about writing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Carl Sauter's new book, How to Sell Your Screenplay, The Real Rules of Film and Television, is published by New Chapter Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, journalist Stanley Karnow, whose new book, In Our Image, traces America's involvement in the Philippines. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Steve Reich's new composition, Different Trains, is based on his memories of traveling cross-country by train as a child and his later realization that at the same time, Jews in Europe were riding the trains to their deaths. Coming up, Reich tells us about composing what he describes as documentary music. Also, pianist Dave McKenna welcomes the return of spring with a medley of spring songs in our weekly performance spot. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews The War Zone, Alexander Stewart's novel about a boy dealing with his sister's incestuous relationship with their father. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Ronald Reagan will not testify in the criminal trial of Oliver North. In California, the former president said the ruling by Federal District Judge Gerhard Gesell speaks for itself. Details on today's court action from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
In a five-page opinion, Judge Gesell wrote that while there is understandable public interest in what a president may have known or may have done, the North trial does not require such a generalized inquiry. The judge said that since the three major conspiracy counts involving presidential affairs have been dismissed, all that remains are specific charges against North involving discrete, identified, alleged criminal conduct. As to the question of whether Mr. Reagan authorized any of the actions that North now faces trial for, actions such as lying to Congress or shredding documents, the judge noted that he'd examined President Reagan's written answers to questions put to him by the special prosecutor, and the judge said he'd also examined material relating to Mr. Reagan's personal diaries. Nothing there, he said, even remotely supports the authorization claim. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Hundreds of oil-covered birds and other animals are being found in Alaska, victims of last Friday's oil spill. State conservation officials say the animals are dying from starvation, ingesting oil, and hypothermia, all caused by the spreading oil slick. State officials and fishermen continue to criticize Exxon for its cleanup effort, charging the company has recovered only 3% of the millions of gallons of spilled oil so far. Unemployed workers are also complaining about Exxon's hiring practices, which they say have left many without sought-after cleanup jobs. The FBI has entered the investigation of the Exxon oil spill, focusing on possible violations of the Federal Clean Water Act. The Basque armed separatist group ETA today threatened to break off a truce if the Spanish government does not publicly acknowledge within 72 hours that it wants a political settlement with ETA. Top Spanish officials have engaged in urgent shuttle diplomacy this week to avoid a resumption of ETA violence. Al Goodman reports.
ETA's threat to end its unilateral ceasefire came amidst rising tension in Spain. ETA on Monday extended its truce until June. It has been in effect since January. Madrid reacted by saying it would continue political conversations with exiled ETA leaders in Algeria. But that was not good enough. ETA wanted the words negotiated political solution, and on Wednesday gave the government 24 hours to change its statement. That deadline has passed and has been replaced by the new 72-hour ultimatum. Madrid has hastily dispatched officials to Algeria and France to try to smooth things out. And Spanish Prime Minister Felipe González met with French President François Mitterrand in Paris today. As part of the truce, ETA wants three of its top leaders in French jails to be freed so they can negotiate for ETA in the Algeria talks. ETA has killed more than 600 people in its 20-year struggle for the independence of Spain's Basque provinces. For National Public Radio, I'm Al Goodman in Madrid.
Tomorrow marks the beginning of an independence plan for Africa's last colony. Under a U.S.-brokered agreement, South Africa is giving Namibia its independence in exchange for the removal of 50,000 Cuban troops in Angola. Today, Angola, Cuba, and South Africa exchanged 16 political prisoners, signaling a start of the agreement. Tomorrow morning, a formal ceasefire between South African troops and Namibian force takes effect. Thousands of Korean students and workers fought riot police in seven cities today, protesting police action against striking shipyard workers. Protesters called for the ouster of President No Tae-woo and accused the government of suppressing the labor movement in favor of business. One radical student group is threatening to launch attacks against the Hyundai Corporation. A three-month strike at a Hyundai shipyard ended yesterday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 12 points to close at 2293.62. Advances led declines 2-1. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Dave McKenna has been described as the hardest swinging pianist of all time. He also has one of the largest repertoires of songs. He once told jazz critic Whitney Balliot that he likes to pass time away while he's playing by free associating song titles and medleys. We asked him to do that for us as a way of celebrating the beginning of spring.
Thank you.
Dave McKenna's latest record is No More Uso for Puzo. This is Fresh Air. Composer Steve Reich is one of the fathers of minimalist music. Although his work has gone through many changes over the years, his new piece, Different Trains, has its roots in his early taped speech pieces from the mid-60s. Different Trains is a composition for string quartet and tape, commissioned for the Kronos Quartet. The piece was inspired by childhood memories. His parents divorced when he was one. His mother moved to Los Angeles. His father stayed in New York. And because they had joint custody, Reich traveled back and forth by train with his governess between the years 1939 and 1942. Looking back on the excitement of these train rides, he realized that if he'd been in Europe, as a Jew, he would have been riding a train to his death. The first movement is set in America before the war. Called what you're doing in Different Trains a form of documentary music. Mm-hmm. That's because you're using actual sounds in it, recordings of real people's voices, real train whistles, sirens.
Yeah, absolutely. It goes back to very early pieces that you probably know, It's Gonna Rain and Come Out, which we're working exclusively just with a short snippet of a recorded voice. So as opposed to, let's say, setting a text the way Schubert has done, the way every composer has done, and the way I've done in, let's say, Tehillim or the desert music. In Different Trains, I'm not setting a text, I'm setting human beings. That's quite a different situation.
What you did is interview the governess who took you on the train rides between New York and Los Angeles. You interviewed a Pullman porter who worked the trains on the years that you drove, that you rode on them, and you interviewed a few Holocaust survivors who are the same age as you are. And you took fragments of their speech and use that as the musical text. I find myself saying their lines over and over. It becomes kind of like music, even though it's speech that you're using.
I think what you're driving at is how can the speech become music, or at least I hope you are.
Yes, exactly.
Because what happened is that I selected each of these sentences, phrases, single words, place names, dates, for what they said to be sure, but also for how they were said. Sometimes when we speak, you or I and everybody, we almost sing. We don't know it. It just goes by in our conversation. But if you isolate it on tape, then you find, for instance, in my governess, when she was talking about one of the trips, she said he went from Chicago to New York, and it was really, I don't have perfect pitch, but it was F-A flat, F-A flat. The Pullman Porter said 1941. And the rule I set for myself was, every time a woman speaks, she'll be doubled note for note by the viola. And every time a man speaks, he'll be doubled note for note by the cello. And my job is to arrange, harmonize, and write counterpoint to something that is a given that I can't change. And that was quite an enjoyable restriction.
So you basically had to transcribe musically the spoken words that you were using.
Exactly. I actually had to sit down with a music paper and go over what they said and hear it again and again until I could get down the notes that were being said. Now, that isn't always the case, but I chose those fragments that were strongly pitched, and then I was able to make that transcription.
The first movement of Different Trains is set in the United States based on your rides back and forth between 1939 and 1942 between New York and Los Angeles. The second movement is the Holocaust, and there's an incredible musical shift that happens right between the first and second movements. Would you describe for us what you're doing there?
Well, what happens right on the button is that the air raid sirens begin right as Rachela, who's a woman from Rotterdam now living in Aragon, says 1940. Musically, I wanted to get something that would come in like a, you know, like a absolute knife stroke and just divide those movements, even though there's no time between them.
1940. In the third and final movement of Different Trains, the movement opens with something closer to more traditional violin playing, a string quartet playing than we've heard earlier on.
Right.
Why?
Well, what happens at the beginning of the third movement is da-da-dee-da-da-da. Da-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da. Well, you've been so used to hearing voices, you wonder what that is. Well, actually, what it is it's Paul, the Hungarian now living in Boston, saying, and the war was over. Da-da-dee-da-da-da. But you don't hear him first because there has been so much speech, so much train whistle, so much siren, so much noise, that the third movement begins to move away from all of this towards music, towards some kind of resolution of the situation, which, of course, can't be resolved. But there is, I think, a good attempt at that in the third movement. I think a successful attempt at it in the third movement. What's happening in the third movement is that paradiddle rhythm of the train has stopped, and now all the rhythms, all the music are going to come out of these speech patterns. Da-da-dee-da-da-da is multiplied into the cello, into the viola, and to the two violins of the quartet, so that when he finally says, and the war was over, his voice is surrounded, if you like, as a mosaic of tiles, each tile being, in fact, a musical rendition of what he says. There is no other train rhythm overriding that, and that's what separates the third movement from the other two movements.
Seems to be getting so much more personal than it's ever been. Your last few pieces, they all have texts that really mean something to you or a story that really connects to you. They seem to really be coming directly out of your life, which isn't to say that any of your other music didn't, but I just sense a kind of emotional depth.
Well, what is it? Charles Olson said, we don't get older, we stand more revealed. I think as you go on, it may just happen, at least to certain people, that what they do becomes more personal. Right now, and for the foreseeable future, I feel very very moved and energized by the possibility of bringing in things from the world that mean something to me, particularly in a documentary sense. And I'm now beginning work on a huge documentary music theater piece, which will use video. And the basic location, which will be videotaped, is in the Middle East, which is, of course, one of the hot spots on the earth right now. And for me, the possibility of bringing that material in, maintaining its documentary reality, and at the same time having the musicians literally imitate, do something that they would musically never do, by getting their musical cues from the sounds of voices and the sounds of things that are happening in the world, is a very inspiring way to make music.
When you write a commission, do you ever have doubts enter your mind, like, what if they don't like this, the person or the group that commissioned me to do it?
Well, I don't have so much those thoughts. I have these thoughts which went through my mind even during different trains. This is preposterous. Who cares that I took train rides before? How pretentious. What a bunch of garbage. Why don't you just do the Holocaust part? Or this Holocaust part will become too overly emotional. It's been done to death. I mean, you name it, and I was ready to junk different trains at least 20 or 30 times.
Wow.
So, yeah, sure. I mean, it wasn't so much fear of what Kronos would think. I just began to think, you know, I'm just completely out to lunch here. What am I doing?
Thanks for talking with us about Different Trains.
Thank you, Terry.
Different Trains is on Steve Reich's new album on Nonesuch Records. Next time, Reich talks with us about the other piece on this record, commissioned for jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg about the decision by Judge Gerhard Gesell that former President Ronald Reagan does not have to testify at the Oliver North trial, and as we've heard, the former president doesn't want to testify. We'll also be hearing about Irvin Mattis. Do you know who he is?
No, I don't.
Oh, you may be hearing about him soon. Irvin Mattis is a man who was homeless in Washington, D.C., spent all his time at the Folger Shakespeare Library, and while there became such an expert on Elizabethan architecture and the London of Shakespeare's day that he's now going to have his book on the subject published.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Five years ago, British writer Alexander Stewart wrote a novel called Glory Be, which satirized California cults and the music business. He's also written some screenplays. Stewart has a new novel called The War Zone. Critic at large Laurie Stone says none of Stewart's previous work hinted at how powerful his new book would be.
Tom is the narrator of Alexander Stewart's startlingly forceful novel, The War Zone. He's 15 when his father, a high-powered architect, moves the family from London to the Devon countryside. Tom's mother, a lawyer, is pregnant and soon gives birth to Jake. Tom's 17-year-old sister, Jessie, dominates Tom's thoughts, and when he discovers that she and their father are having an affair, the boy is propelled out of his habitual cynical detachment. The scenes depicting incest and violence are harrowing. Jessie is shown to have instigated the sex, although her father eagerly complies. But the shocks aren't gratuitous. They catapult Tom to emotional and moral clarity. Tom's voice is the book's dominant, masterful element. It's an unstaunchable stream of bilious wit that is part assaultive weapon and part lifeline to his humanity. You can hear it in this typically wry take on his baby brother. He looks okay to me. He looks like he's having wet dreams or maybe planning the baby aspirin dealership that's going to set him up. Jake looks like a survivor, but you never can tell. There are times when he looks small and helpless like any other baby, but I think he's only faking. The war zone is awash in unnaturalness. Everything appears tainted, sickened, and the language is nauseated. Tom is intoxicated with Jessie. She is the sublimely knowing and cool older sibling, a creature who maintains her power by alternately withholding and flashing information. Tom paints her as larger than life in every dimension, more carnal, depraved, needy, sexy, inscrutable. She eclipses his vision of other beings, and his longing and frustration don't let up. Tom is poisoned by his hormones, outraged by the tyrannies of biological change. He's strung out between childhood and adulthood, and he feels at home only in London's sooty, punkoid squalor, where deviance and disconnectedness are incorporable. But objective toxicities plague Tom as well. He is a child of global pollution. He's conscious that the milk he drinks is laced with Chernobyl fallout, and he counts the plastic bags floating in the ocean. A nuke-age kid brought up amid reports of spiraling terrorism, he tacks a picture of a Beirut teenager over his bed. The world is in dire straits, and so is his family, and Tom can't determine cause and effect. Are his father and sister having an affair because he's too weak to stop them? Or because they've been poisoned by the world? Or is incest, like radioactive waste, blighting the age? "What's wrong with you?" Jesse asks, and Tom answers, "Cancer? AIDS? The fact that I've got a sister who lets her father have her right up her arse?" With all the book's darkness, Alexander Stewart isn't a nihilist. The war zone is stark and sad. In Jesse, eroticism is plunder. In Tom, romance burns, but the boy does come to see beyond his fantasies. He sees that there are too many accidents, doors left ajar, and forests burned. Fear of God, which used to restrain people from violence and self-destruction, hasn't been replaced by tenderness, by a sense that life is worthy of saving on its own. "Why," Tom rages at the members of his family, "can't you love me better?" "Why," he asks, "can't you love yourselves and the world better?"
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. She reviewed The War Zone by Alexander Stewart. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, in the second part of our interview with composer Steve Reich, he discusses Electric Counterpoint, his new piece written for jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by tenor saxophonist and composer David Murray, and television critic David Bianculli previews the new ABC sitcom, The Robert Guillaume Show. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Fred Lander, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Peter Murdoch. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.